Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CCXLI, Crassus and the Triumvirate. As Crassus gathered more power and wealth, his success was aided by two allies. One, Julius Caesar, had received financial aid from Crassus for many years. The other, Pompeius Magnus, was at the best of times a bitter rival. Together they formed the Triumvirate, more powerful together than apart. Here's Rhiannon Evans. Previously on Emperors of Rome, we finished the podcast at about 70 BCE, but now we're going to skip forward to 65 BCE. Crassus is living it up in Rome as a rich and influential politician, happily married to his brother's widow, two sons who we haven't mentioned.
Marcus and Publius.
And in the meantime, while all of this is happening, Pompey is the one to watch because he is getting very powerful and rich and influential by being a bloody good general. He's off fighting and having victories and doing what Crassus would probably prefer to be doing.
Yeah, you do get the feeling with Crassus that Pompey or someone else is always coming in and claiming the glory. Mm-hmm. So Pompey had been given a kind of unusual task of not going and conquering a place, but ridding the Mediterranean of pirates, which had been kind of decades of trouble for the Romans and their trade routes.
Yeah.
And nobody had really managed to get a grip on this, and Pompey does it really quickly.
Okay, so this isn't the Pompey series, which we should probably do at some point. We'll put it on the list. We're doing Crassus now. Crassus would be very happy with that. So we now get to 65 BCE. Crassus is elected censor.
Yes.
Okay, so tell me about that.
Well, according to Plutarch, this is kind of meaningless. Of course, it's a big honor for Crassus, but Plutarch says that both the consulship and the censorship are pretty empty of action. Let me quote from chapter 13 of Plutarch's life. When he was censor, he accomplished literally nothing at all. You can't really get more damning than that.
Mm.
There was no revision of the list of senators. This is one of the major tasks of the censor, to get rid of anyone who doesn't have enough money or has acted in an immoral way. No review of the property classes who had served in war, and no census of the population. So he sees him as very inactive in this role. And he says that this is even less explicable because his colleague in the censorship, who was Quintus Lutatius Catulus Capitolinus, great name.
I do like that name. I was going to say that.
We usually call him Catulus. He basically says Catulus is a pretty easygoing guy and he could have got stuff done. And then there's a rumor, or at least they say, that the censors then argued, which makes it sound like he thinks it's Crassus's fault because he's mentioned that Catulus is not an aggressive or kind of oppositional type person. They argued about Crassus's attempt to annex Egypt. Now, this is interesting in light of the fact that nothing's going to happen with Egypt here,
yep.
But we know it will later,
mm.
And that this is the reason that they both gave up the censorship. So didn't get on anymore because Catulus didn't back this. Of course, all of this feeds into Plutarch's obsession with Crassus being greedy because Egypt is vastly wealthy. And there's sort of a question that modern ancient historians have asked, was Crassus after the governorship, was, you know, annexing it would have meant a good place for him to go as a proconsul.
Mm, somewhere to make money for. Mm. Yeah, okay. And during this time, speaking of money, it's probably always wise to point out that he is financially supporting Caesar.
He is indeed. And this relationship between Caesar, the rising star, and Crassus, who seems to be funding him, is one that will continue. It'll be important for the rest of Crassus's life, really.
Yeah.
The way that, we'll see Caesar's very important in what happens.
Yeah, he backed the right horse there, definitely.
Yeah, so this financial support means that Caesar gets to be Pontifex Maximus again. This makes Caesar much more prominent. And as you say, it means that Crassus has somebody who will, you know, there'll be a quid pro quo for him because he has underwritten this. It's always worth remembering that Caesar is, you know, you're quite right, he's backed the right horse, but Caesar is good for Crassus because Caesar comes from a very aristocratic family. He's incredibly talented, but he doesn't have the funds.
Mm. Okay, so now 63 BCE, so a couple of years later, if we scoot along, the conspiracy of Catiline.
see previous episodes of Emperors of Rome from last year. So a bit more current than the Spartacus stuff that we were talking about the previous episode. So just briefly for those people who don't want to dredge up all those episodes.
How can they not want to listen to them again?
I know. Some of the greatest hits. What's a kind of nutshell of the Catiline conspiracy? And then we'll go into Crassus's involvement in it.
Well, the story is, at least the story from Cicero's point of view, is that Catiline's an aggrieved aristocrat who tries to overturn the government and murder Cicero and other prominent Romans. There's a war, basically. I mean, some accounts of it are the war with Catiline, not the conspiracy. Crassus's part in it, it's all very shady, is that none of this was really confirmed until Crassus comes forward with letters that apparently outline plans to massacre these prominent citizens. So it's Crassus who says, I've been sent these letters, these anonymous letters.
Blows the lid right off it.
Yeah, that exposes everything.
So I assume that these letters were an attempt to recruit him, if they're letters to Crassus?
I think it's possible that this is somebody within trying to expose the conspiracy, but it's a problem for Crassus because it might look like he's involved.
Mm.
So, you know, as I say, largely we have Cicero's account, which, as we said in our Catiline conspiracy series, we have to be suspicious of because he has a lot to gain from painting Catiline in a particular light. And he has something to gain possibly by throwing shade on Crassus too.
Mm.
I find it hard to think, given what we have already said about Crassus, that it would be worth his while throwing his lot in with Catiline. He just doesn't seem as desperate. I think he's doing the right thing backing Caesar, but then we do have the benefit of hindsight. We know that Catiline didn't succeed. We know that Caesar becomes a star.
Yeah. He would have, at the very least, come upon this information, either through an attempted recruitment or he's been given it to leak, and he would have carefully considered, which side of this do I want to be on?
I mean, I think it's likely they might have tried to get him on side because, of course, who wouldn't try and get Crassus on side because you need funding?
Mm.
So everyone's always begging for his help, presumably.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether he would have been at all sympathetic to that, I mean, in the end, he did turn the letters in.
Yes.
So there was a reason why he gave this information over.
Okay, so he turns the letters in.
But there's a kind of lingering suspicion that we get from our sources.
The other involvement he has with the Catiline conspiracy, and this is just a bit peripheral, is that later on during the wrapping up of all of this, the conspirators are being implicated and Crassus is implicated by somebody and so is Caesar, but it is not believed. It is disregarded and the person who implicates him is put to death.
And Plutarch says, now this is all very whispers of whispers, that Cicero later implicated Crassus and Caesar. But this is not in his famous Catilinarian speeches, not at all, which he gives at the time. Instead, it's in a speech that we don't have that was made after both Caesar and Crassus were dead. So it's after March 44.
Yeah.
Cicero doesn't live that long after that, so it's a very tight turnaround time.
Yeah.
Anyway, according to Plutarch, Crassus now despised Cicero, I guess because of these rumors, but kept this under wraps because his son, Crassus's son Publius, was dedicated to learning, I guess, especially oratory, and was a supporter of Cicero. So there was a kind of divide in the family. So he can't openly come out against Cicero.
Publius is the younger son?
Yes. In fact, we're told that Publius goes into mourning clothes when Cicero was exiled, which is what you normally do when someone's on trial to support them. It all sounds very soap opera to me. And, you know, to a certain extent, we have to know that Plutarch is fond of these kind of anecdotes and especially of characterizing people in a particular way. And I guess what this does with Plutarch's characterization of Crassus is it sees him as kind of divided, of having to keep this enmity under wraps.
Mm-hmm.
So just as an aside here, Crassus's son, Marcus, his elder son, marries Caecilia Metella at this point. And this allies Crassus with a very powerful and conservative man, her father, Metellus, who is also an enemy of Pompey.
Mm.
So as we'll see, this kind of is just yet another thing that stokes this antagonism with Pompey.
Okay. So this is still 63.
A lot happens in 63.
I know. Spinning out of the conspiracy and after this. When I was reading through this, my thought was Crassus and Pompey really start to roadblock each other, just in everything. And it seemed more out of pettiness, not that this is going to gain me anything, but it's just, I don't want you to have anything.
Well, I mean, to be fair to them, everybody is part of a zero-sum game at this point, even more than normally in the Republican system. Getting to be consul is a dog-eat-dog election, right? Only two people can get there every year. But because the strictures of the Republic are starting to break down, people have had repeated consulships, breaking all kinds of rules. People who are too young get to be consuls. Pompey had been too young in 70 BCE, according to the rules of being 42. It's also a time when it's starting to become obvious that having an army loyal to you is a good thing, and that power broking is going on kind of outside of the Republican system. So it's not really surprising that they're very suspicious of each other.
Mm.
You know, they're both contenders for having extreme extra constitutional power in Rome. Pompey has had so many military victories. He's got so much glory at this point and will gain a lot more shortly. And Crassus has so much money.
Mm.
And they've both been consuls in the same year. I'm not surprised that they come and butt heads.
So in the meantime, we've got Pompey having military victories against Mithridates of Pontus.
Mm. He's defeated in 63, so another big event of 63 BCE.
Yes.
So kind of a new province. Oh, Pontus is annexed to Bithynia, so makes it an extra big province.
Okay.
So out in the east. But Crassus, now this is, I think, a little bit like the Spartacus narrative again. Crassus really takes umbrage on behalf of his ally Lucullus, because Lucullus had been the commander earlier in the campaign.
Oh, just like, hey, he did all the hard work and Pompey just mopped up things and now he's getting the glory again.
It's the old, I loosened the jar and now you've opened it narrative.
Yes.
It certainly can run like that. And Lucullus, maybe we should do an episode on him at some point. He's an interesting character.
Wait, just let me open my list tab. I do have a list tab.
I do wonder whether Crassus is more annoyed about it than Lucullus is almost. Anyway, it's another reason for Crassus to feel that Pompey is undermining the glory that other people deserve, which he might well have felt about Pompey being credited with finishing off the army of Spartacus in the Servile War. Pompey seems very good at soaking up glory and seeming essential. It's very hard, I think, for anybody, for Crassus or anybody else, to claim that Pompey is overrated because he just stacks up so much military success.
Yeah, it's a bit hard to argue with all that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of unstoppable in Roman imperialistic terms.
Mm.
And I do think that ridding Rome of the problem of the pirates is really the one that sticks for Pompey. The glory that he gets and the huge amount of wealth from Pontus, from defeating Mithridates. And this is, you know, this is the third war against Mithridates. So this is something that Rome feels is like this constant needling needs to be finished. And he's the one who finishes it.
Mm.
And it brings huge wealth in. And Pompey's very showy in his triumph. This must really needle Crassus, but it'd be very hard for anyone else to take the spotlight away from Pompey at this point.
Yes, yes. So in the meantime, we've got equestrians who are patroned by Crassus. They lobby for tax relief. They overbid on tax contracts in the province of Asia. So they bid on tax contracts, get the tax contracts, expect to make more money, and then get annoyed and cry poor. Ironically, when they don't make enough money that they think they don't make good on their investments, and they think that Crassus is the person to help them out here.
Well, he's the man who knows money.
Yeah. And also, you know, he's patroned these people, so he wants to keep face by being seen as a good patron.
Yes. So this is the patron-client relationship that he has with them. This means that he's got people coming to him and asking for favors in return, and they're kind of a minor power block for him. And the reason that these contracts are devalued is the Mithridatic War, is the war with Mithridates.
Yes. So again, Pompey's fault.
Possibly so. This did not work, however. The Senate aren't having this. And Cicero says it was ridiculous for the tax farmers to seek to have their contracts renegotiated or cancelled simply because they had overestimated their potential profits. No sympathy from Cicero.
And then a roadblocking again. Crassus opposes Pompey's settlements. So this is settlements of his veterans and land bills. And so this is in 60 BCE.
Yes. So this is the army that he's brought back from that Mithridatic War.
Mm.
And now he wants to reward them. And this sort of becomes a trope, something that keeps happening with these, again, these commanders that have these armies very loyal to them, not necessarily to Rome first anymore. And the land bill is part of that. You know, we need land to settle these veterans on.
Mm.
And if we don't do that, then we've still got this army that's active. So either way, you want to do something about it.
So Crassus opposes this, but Crassus isn't just one person. He's very rich.
Yeah, Crassus manages to mobilize his supporters, who he's probably, he will have helped out with money in the Senate. And that's enough influence, enough authority for this to never see the light of day.
Mm. So it's this getting in the way of each other that is likely, it is one of the contributing factors to Caesar kind of trying to make peace between the two of them. We're getting to the first triumvirate here, and Caesar is credited with the creation of that, probably by Caesar.
Well, maybe. I mean, certainly all of our sources talk about him as the, I mean, they make him sound like he should be all of the UN and every diplomat in the world, because we've had so much of a narrative of Crassus and Pompey not being able to sit in the same room. They oppose each other on everything.
They wouldn't hold hands at the end of their consulship. I can see this being realistic as Caesar needing the one to come in and go, you two are achieving nothing, but if we work together, oh, the things that we could achieve.
Mm-hmm. He's clearly very, very persuasive. And I think when, I know we're dealing with Crassus, but I just want to say a word for my man.
Big up, Caesar.
But Caesar is often credited with having great power with the crowd, but he's clearly very good at manipulating people on an individual basis, at talking them around. Or at least our sources suggest that he's the one who does this, and it sort of makes sense because it becomes the three of them together.
Yes, and Caesar is somebody who Crassus trusts. So if Caesar says, look, we should work together, Crassus will come on board for that, and Pompey would see the benefit of doing it. Yeah. I can see all of that happening.
So on this Appian, in his the second book of his Civil War, chapter 9, he says, Pompey was indignant and made friends with Caesar and promised under oath to support him for the consulship. So indignant with Crassus, you know, after Crassus has stopped him getting his veterans' land.
Yeah.
The latter, Caesar, thereupon brought Crassus into friendly relations with Pompey. Easy. So these three most powerful men pooled their interests. This coalition, the Roman writer Varro treated of in a book entitled Tricaranus, the Three-Headed Monster. Well, I wish we had that book.
That's a great book title.
I know. Varro wrote so much, and we've got like little fragments and one book on agriculture.
Yes. So we are now 60 BCE. A lot happened in that year.
Well, a lot's happening a lot of the time as the Republic falls apart.
The first triumvirate has now been formed.
But it's not formal. So even though we call it the first triumvirate, let's just be clear that the one that Crassus is involved in is not as formal as the second one that'll come up between Octavian and Mark Antony and Lepidus.
So informal, a secret. Nobody knows about it at this point.
Yes. How long are you going to be able to keep this secret? Especially if you consider that Crassus is constantly opposing everything Pompey wants. And then all of a sudden, he's not anymore.
He's not anymore. In fact, it seems to be that he's probably helping him and they're working together. Mm. And what is all of this that's happening? Yeah. It definitely stinks of deal making, everything that they do. So the first deal is the year after. So something happens, 59 BCE.
Yeah, so both Crassus and Pompey will now support Caesar to become consul in 59, which is his ambition because it's his year. Unlike Pompey, he doesn't become consul before he's old enough. And during this time, of course, it becomes clear that Crassus and Pompey no longer fighting, so people start to realize there is an alliance going on there. Dio Cassius suggests that Caesar is very much the glue sticking it all together. As we've kind of already mentioned, he's the peace broker. But he says Crassus and Pompey still have this unresolved antagonism, and they're both anxious. He kind of depicts something, I think it's interesting, psychologically about losing out to the other two. So there's a kind of way that maybe Caesar's playing on these anxieties, or the anxieties are that Caesar will support one and not the other.
Mm.
It just seems like a very dysfunctional trio from the start. Anyway, this is what he says in book 37. Pompey and Crassus, the moment they really set about it, made peace with each other for reasons of their own, and they took Caesar into partnership in their plans. For Pompey, on his side, was not so strong as he'd hoped to be, which is amazing given the amount of military success.
I know, I'm just thinking, how much stronger can he get? Yeah.
And seeing that Crassus was powerful and that Caesar's influence was growing, feared that he would be utterly overthrown by them. And he hoped that if he made them allies, he would win back his old authority through them. Crassus thought he ought to be in power because of his elite background as well as his wealth. And since he was far inferior, I'm not quite sure what Dio means there, but I assume in talent, military to Pompey. So he's far inferior to Pompey. That's why I think it's probably in military success, because that's what Pompey kind of has at this point. Since he was far inferior to Pompey and thought that Caesar was going to rise to great heights, he wanted to set them in opposition to each other in order that neither of them should get the upper hand. He expected that they would be well matched in antagonists and that he would get the benefit of the friendship with both and gain greater honours than either of them. Okay, now I have to say, of course, Dio is writing in the 3rd century, very much with the benefit of hindsight. So the idea that Caesar was going to rise to great heights, he knows, and that they will be well matched antagonists, civil war, Dio knows, Crassus does not and doesn't live to see it.
Mm.
So we do have a little bit of that going on. At least the way Dio paints it, we have both of them being, I don't know, anxious, and he makes them sound like they're kind of psychologically scared of the other one and they need to keep in with Caesar so that Caesar doesn't join up with the other one and become super powerful. So even more than Caesar being the one who brings Crassus and Pompey together, he makes Crassus sound like someone who's really worried that if Caesar and Pompey get together, it's game over for him.
Yeah, doesn't want to be left out, yeah. Okay.
It's very schoolyardy, isn't it?
Politics usually are.
And Plutarch also suggests even further that Caesar manipulates the other two, making the argument that they need to join forces against other more conservative power brokers. So that Caesar's saying, if Pompey and Crassus continue to attack one another, so this is more about joining them together as a force than playing them off against each other. If they continue to be at odds, then they'll just increase the authority of people like Cato, like Cicero, like Catulus. And Plutarch puts Crassus's willingness to join the triumvirate down to both his monetary greed, which of course Plutarch likes to keep reminding us of, and a new hunger for trophies and triumph. So again, that jealous of Pompey idea. The only field in which he's not Caesar's, or I guess Pompey's equal, at least according to Crassus. And to quote Plutarch, chapter 14 of the life, this passion of his gave him no rest or peace until it ended in an inglorious death and a national disaster.
Wow, spoilers, Plutarch.
I know.
Yeah, what are you doing?
Again, he knows what's coming up. And he's putting it down to Crassus's character, as he always does. It's not just greed for money now, it's greed for glory.
Meanwhile, we've got developments, benefits of being in a triumvirate, and that is that Caesar successfully pushes through an agrarian law.
So what Crassus didn't want.
Yes, which helps resettle Pompey's veterans.
It's not clear what Crassus gets out of it at this point. He'll get something a bit later.
He will.
We don't get to hear of anything right now. So Caesar gets to be, after his year as consul in 59, in 58 he gets to be proconsul of Gaul, which he really wants.
Mm-hmm.
As he presumably always intends to push further into Gaul, which, you know, the Romans have a province in Provence, but they don't have what you think of as France and Belgium at that point, and he's looking for military glory there and money. But we're not really told of Crassus getting anything out of it. So I do wonder if what Plutarch and Dio tell us of it just making Crassus feel like at least he's in there, he's in the game by being in a group with these two, you know, one up and coming, the other already hugely famous and glorious, that he's not being left out, because we're not told of Crassus getting any benefits at this moment.
Now we're going to fast forward a few years and just say that, you know, the triumvirate is something that exists, but it seems to have a bit of an ebb and flow. Especially since during this time, Caesar, after his consulship, gets the proconsulship of Gaul. and goes off and has his massive war campaign.
Yeah, and also he's got a very unusual five-year proconsulship. Mm. So usually you get 1 year. And this means the three of them don't come together for a few years. And there's the potential for this to all fray.
Interesting side note is that both of Crassus's sons are off at the Gallic Wars with Caesar. The younger son, Publius, is quite junior in rank, but the older one, Marcus, is mentioned in the Gallic Wars. He's a quaestor and later, I think, a higher rank proquaestor. That could be wanting to keep the families closer together.
Keep an eye on Caesar.
maybe keeping an eye on Caesar.
There's also, I mean, you could see it as a mentorship, you know, learning the ways of war with Caesar.
Yeah. Then we get to 56 BCE, so a few more years, when you have a renewal of this triumvirate with a conference, which is what we're calling it in Lucca.
The Lucca conference.
This is during a bit of downtime from the war.
Yes. So Caesar tends to come back into what we think of as northern Italy now, but they called Cisalpine Gaul at the time, which is meant to be where he's proconsul of. He spends most of his time in bits of Gaul. He's not proconsul of fighting. He comes back and does the assizes, so acts as a judge, which is part of his role in winter when he can't campaign. They haven't seen each other for a few years since Caesar's been in Gaul. Lucca is near Pisa. It's a very beautiful medieval walled town now. I recommend going. It is as far south as Caesar can go without leaving his province in Cisalpine Gaul. It's pretty clear that Pompey mistrusts Crassus at this point and tells Cicero he believes Crassus is supporting Clodius, who's seen as one of Caesar's men and his tribune of the plebs back in Rome in the 50s. And Suetonius tells us, now of course Suetonius doesn't have a life of Crassus, but this is from his life of Caesar in chapter 24. Caesar made Pompey and Crassus come to Lucca, a city in his province, where he persuaded them to seek a second consulship, thwart Domitius, who's one of their enemies, and secure for him a five-year extension to his provincial command. So he wants even more time. Time's running out. He gets the gang together.
It's a conference with an agenda.
Oh, yes. The way we're told it is that it's very much Caesar's agenda and that he is worried. Maybe he's heard rumours. He's definitely got people in Rome giving him news back.
Well, again, I can believe that this is a conference that Caesar has called because he's dictated the location of it. Mm-hmm. Nothing had really happened in the meantime with the triumvirate. And just given the relationship between Pompey and Crassus, I can believe that Caesar is the one who instigated all of this.
Well, it seems like he can see problems ahead for him. Mm. And there are problems ahead for him because he won't be allowed back into Rome unless he gives up his army.
Yeah.
And he knows he's got enemies there. And that's why he wants Pompey and Crassus to be consuls again for 55 BC. So he wants them to stand for that contest. The election gets postponed, which is very unusual. And the reason is political. It's so that Caesar could return some of his soldiers to Rome to vote for them.
Mm. So we've got quite a lot of different accounts about this meeting. So you quoted Suetonius before. We've got an account in that. Most people are mentioning it as part of Caesar's biography or writing about Caesar. So it's in Plutarch, three different accounts in Plutarch, because he's written about Caesar, Pompey and Crassus, given biographies to each. Interestingly, Crassus is the most detailed on the Lucca conference. It's the longest kind of passage that he wrote.
I do wonder if it's because
he had less to write about Crassus.
Yeah, it's really sad to say, isn't it?
I said it. I went there. So, yeah.
The other two live longer, I guess there is that.
But it's also in Dio. We've got Appian writing about it. We've got Cicero writing about it. So there's a contemporary source. What quotes would you like to read out about it?
So in Plutarch, we're told, in the life of Crassus, when Caesar came down to the city of Lucca from Gaul, many Romans came to meet him, among them Pompey and Crassus. I feel like this already puts Crassus and even Pompey at a disadvantage that they have to come to Caesar. The whole power dynamic's changing a bit for them. At private conferences, the three decided to tighten their grip on politics and to make themselves sole masters of the state. This is pretty extreme stuff. Caesar was to remain in his command while Pompey and Crassus were to take other provinces and armies. But the only way to secure this end was by soliciting a second consulship, that is 55 BCE. Mm. Pompey and Crassus were to be candidates for this. Caesar was to cooperate with them by writing letters to his friends and by sending many of his soldiers home to support them at elections. And this breeds suspicion back in Rome, particularly that Crassus and Pompey are going to stand for election again. So Plutarch actually continues, with this understanding, Crassus and Pompey returned to Rome and people at once suspected what their plans were. And everywhere the view was that their meeting with Caesar had been for no good purpose. Plutarch tells us that Pompey is seen as proud and arrogant here. And in response to that, and kind of realizing that this was not a good look, Crassus said more modestly that if it was for the interest of the city, he would be a candidate for the office, but otherwise he would not. Mm. Right? It's like, if my party begs me to do it, if the people really need me.
Yes, I'm reluctantly putting myself forward.
Very.
Yeah.
And you just know that that person is extremely ambitious at that point, don't you?
Mm.
For this reason, various people, including Domitius, enemy, remember, were bold enough to stand for the consulship. So somebody has to stand against these people, is the idea. When, however, Pompey and Crassus openly announced their candidature, most grew frightened. So this is kind of damning, that the atmosphere is, if these two are standing, then we don't go up against them.
Mm.
So the others withdraw from the contest. But Cato encouraged Domitius, who was a relative and a friend of his, to fight the election, urging him to cling to his hopes and to do battle for the common freedom. For it was not the consulate, he said, which Crassus and Pompey wanted, but a tyranny. And their actions meant they were not just thinking of being elected to office, but of seizing provinces and armies for themselves. So this is not popular. This idea that they're going to have the consulship again together. They already had it in 70. And in Plutarch, there's a lot of, well, don't we have other good candidates? We're living through this in so many countries, I feel. Like, oh, it's just these same guys again.
Yeah.
You know, don't we have good young people coming through?
But I think that this says something, though, about the power that Pompey and Crassus and Caesar have as the triumvirate. They're very much roadblocking. They're strong-arming the Senate. If they want to be consul, then they get it.
And they have followers themselves. And these followers are alarmed by this opposition coming from the likes of Cato and Domitius.
Mm.
They physically attack Domitius as he exits the forum, actually killing one of the people around him. So I'm going to carry on with even more Plutarch, because it's just very dramatic. After routing their opponents and shutting them up at home, they had themselves proclaimed consuls, and a short time afterwards, they once more surrounded the rostra with armed men, threw Cato out of the forum, killed several who made resistance, and then passed decrees to add another 5 years to the proconsulship of Caesar in Gaul, while they themselves had provinces and armies voted to them. So exactly what Cato said was going to happen.
Mm.
But of course, that's probably Plutarch knowing what's going to happen and saying, Cato said this would happen. When the lot was cast, because it's meant to be by lot that you get your province allotted to you, Syria fell to Crassus and the Spanish provinces to Pompey.
That's okay.
Plutarch, Life of Crassus, chapter 15.
So this is what ultimately Crassus gets out of the triumvirate.
Yes. And look, Syria is a rich eastern province, but it's also the pathway to Parthia. You can launch an attack on the great Parthian Empire from here.
Mm.
And this is pretty much the one big power left in the Mediterranean world, the world as the Romans know it, that has never been an area that they could conquer or, you know, come to an agreement with.
Mm.
So this is very definitely Crassus's bid for glory, that he wants to go against Parthia.
But Crassus probably believes that by having a military victory in Parthia, he's finally going to be able to equal, if not best, the glory that Caesar has had in Gaul and that Pompey has had in insert any other war that I've fought since then.
Yeah, Pontus in particular, I think.
Yeah.
But really, when you think of what the three men have from the triumvirate, they all have substantial armies out in the field. They have access to them and potentially loyal armies. Crassus is finally going to have the opportunity to rival Caesar and Pompey's achievements. And this apparently is what he's after at this stage. And so we go to Parthia.
That was Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe, leave a review, and tell your friends about it. You can follow the Emperors of Rome on our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Blue Sky. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. Emperors of Rome has been recorded and produced at the Bundoora campus of La Trobe University on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.